The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I got to say, I feel bad for whoever I have on afterwards, because Michael Juergens, who is joining me, the owner of the Bhutan Wine Company, senior partner at Dilett, might have the most interesting story I've ever heard of when it comes to wine. Michael, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. This is great.
Yeah, so let's just dive right in. I've ran seven marathons in my day, and my main thought when I'm running these marathons is, how much further do I have to go, and what wine am I going to drink when I finish running 42 kilometers? But for you, you running in the kingdom of Bhutan, and I'm probably mispronouncing it, you had different sort of thoughts going on, didn't you?
Yeah. Bhutan is actually the
Bhutan,
way that you would
thank
say
you.
It.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Bhutan.
Yeah, although I will say, so I have run the Alsace Marathon, which has 12 wine and food pairings along the way. And I've also run the Bordeaux Marathon, where you stop at every winery and drink. So I am 100% aligned with you on the wine drinking marathons, too.
And we're going to get to that, by the way. I want to get, because I want to run that Bordeaux Marathon. But I'm sorry, continue with your story.
But okay, yeah, let's talk about Bhutan. So Bhutan is this country in the Himalayas, and it's this... it's kind of tucked in between Tibet and Nepal. And it is just this Garden of Eden kind of place. It's isolated and has these isolated valleys. And in these valleys, they grow some of the world's best crops in certain verticals. And it literally, it's the best like cucumber you've ever eaten in your life, the best carrot. Like everything you eat is like this unbelievable stuff. So me being a wine geek, I'm over there and I'm running the marathon. I went to run the marathon and I'm looking at all these slopes and all these crops. And in my head, I'm like, oh, this is a place that wine grapes must be somewhere. I just have to find them. So I asked everybody, everywhere I went, I was like, where are the vineyards? And everybody looked at me like, I was like, what are you talking about? What's a vineyard? And I'm like, you know, like for wine. And they're like, no, we don't know. So eventually I got to this dinner with some government officials and I said, hey, well, I'm here in your country. I want to visit your wineries. And they said, we don't have any. And I, you know, as you've been drinking a little bit, you know, you sort of, you know, you get noisome about, hey, like you guys are really screwing up if you don't do this. Like this is, you must do this for your country. This is a must do. You must create a wine industry here, you must plant vineyards. And I just thought it would be cool if they did it. I never had a desire to be the guy that was doing it. But yeah, that's kind of how it all started, was with this very first marathon I ran.
What was more difficult, planting the grapes or convincing the government to let you do it?
Well, so remember, I didn't kind of set out to convince the government to let me do it. I just thought it would be cool if they did it.
Right.
And so the way it went down was, actually, when I'm at this dinner, I'm telling these people that they should do it. And they're asking me like why I think it will work. And so I rattle off some reasons, but I went home and I actually kind of did some thinking on it. And I did some research, got what data I could. And I wrote a white paper saying, this is why I think the Kingdom of Bhutan would be great for growing fine wine grapes. And I emailed it to them. And that was the last I heard of it for a couple of years. And so unbeknownst to me, there was a lot of discussion going on in the country about whether or not to do this, but I wasn't involved in any of it.
Right.
You know, I was just like, I threw the white paper over the transom and, you know, hey, let me know when it's done. I want to come visit. So I went back like 2 years later to run the marathon again, because we had so much fun the first time. And when I was back there, all these government officials wanted to get meetings with me. And everyone's like, oh, are you the wine guy? And I'm like, yeah, I'm the wine guy. And they're like, we want to talk to you. So I'm meeting with like the head of the Ministry of Agriculture and the head of the Ministry of Economic Affairs and stuff like that. And everyone's asking kind of thoughtful questions about how to do it. And so apparently there was a lot of discussion occurred where they were kind of evaluating whether or not it would make sense. And so then I kind of got reinserted into the dialogue a couple of years later, and they said, okay, we are convinced that this is worth trying. And it's for five, they had five or six really good reasons why they wanted to do it as a country. And they said to me, like, how would we go about it? Like tactically. And I said, no problem. Went back to California, wrote a 10-year business plan, identified all the work streams, all the dependencies in the work plan and everything that needed to be done, all the things they needed to consider. And I just emailed it to them. Here you go. Here's your roadmap. Once again, I was never sitting there like banging the gong saying, hey, let me do this with you. I was like, this would be really awesome if you guys did this. You should totally do this. This will be globally relevant. I believe it will be globally relevant on the world wine scene. And I think you will be able to make some amazing stuff based on my knowledge, my experience, and what I see you guys doing now with fruit. That's not grapes. And so, you know, they said, this makes a lot of sense. We want to do this. I go, you should do it. And they go, we're probably going to need a partner. And I'm like, yeah, you should probably get a knowledgeable partner. And they're like, yeah, you're not picking up what we're putting down. Like, we wanted to do this with
you. You're doing this. You're.
Like, oh, shit.
Yeah. How? By the way.
like we're going to do this together as a team. Huh? All right.
How shocked were you?
It was just way too awesome an adventure to pass up.
Yeah. How shocked were you, Michael? That when you went back to run the second marathon, that A, they were still ruminating your idea that you threw out on that one on the white page, and like, how shocked were you when you realized, wait a minute, this is actually going to happen?
I would say I was mildly shocked, mm-hmm. for sure. I was more shocked that they wanted to do it with me.
Right.
Because, you know, I just felt like this, it makes so much sense and it fits in so well with a lot of their strategic initiatives for the country that it seemed to me like a no-brainer. And they just kind of had to think about it themselves and go, yeah, that's a no-brainer. So that was mildly shocking. But then when they kind of pulled the trigger and said, hey, we want to partner with you to do this, I was like, whoa, okay, that's a whole different ball of wax. And, I live in Los Angeles. That's not convenient to the Himalayas.
No, that's not many direct flights from where you are, right to Bhutan. What's interesting here, Michael, is just the mix, just a nice balance of your ego. And I mean this in a good way. You have a strong enough ego where you're like, this is a good idea. I'd like to help them, but not this giant one where you then thought, I should be the one spearheading the entire wine production. Like, it's an interesting balance that you have there.
Well, it's funny you say that. I think I am just super, super passionate about wine. And I think that in many places around the world, we do wine wrong, particularly in the United States. Like, we made this whole big thing out of it. It's all this pomp and circumstance and people are super intimidated by it. But it really is a joyous thing that brings people together. And that's what it should be. And Bhutan is like this, I mean, literally, it's the happiest place on earth, right? That's the tagline. It is this joyous, serene place. Like, you'd think it would be the epicenter for wine. And I just wanted to see them do something amazing so I could participate in drinking it. And it was truly just a passion thing for me, like, do this. And I was sincere about it. I put a lot of time and effort of my own into trying to help them, you know, move down that path to realizing that dream without ego in it, without this sort of, oh, I'm going to make $1 million or I'm going to get to be the guy or whatever. It was just like, the world needs this. You should do it.
So, all right. So now they want to partner up with you. Where are we now? I believe you planted in April, going through my notes, in April of 2000, I think it was 2019, Where are we now?
So I have six vineyards that mm-hmm. just finished their fourth harvest.
Right.
Or fourth leaf. I have grapes in about half of those vineyards. There's a couple sites that are at around 9,000 feet in altitude. So they're taking a little bit longer to come online, which is fine. I actually want those grapes to struggle a little bit and I want to see what comes out of that. And then I have two vineyards that just finished their second growing season. And I b- both of those we planted in slightly warmer locations, and both of those vineyards started to get a little bit of fruit this year. So I'm super optimistic about getting a harvest out of them next year. But I think next year will be our first production run. We could have made wine this year. We had enough grapes to make wine, but the pandemic was causing a lot of issues. And so we ended up just making a strategic decision to let the grapes fall. And it really was less about Bhutan and more about India. You know, India was a complete disaster,
right,
you know, in the springtime. And so a lot of those Indians were trying to seek refuge other places, Bhutan being one of them, because they can just drive there. And so Bhutan completely closed the borders down and just implemented a giant lockdown policy. So it was difficult for us to get things like winemaking equipment there. And by the way, in the middle of all this, I was trying to plant like 50 acres of grapes. So I'm like trying to ship grapes, like roots there. But everything's on complete lockdown. So that was like this just comedy of errors trying to get these grapevines in the country. But it all worked out. We got it done. I still look back on the last 6 months and kind of shake my head going, I can't believe we pulled that off. But we did.
Oh yeah. And also the part that'd be hardest is, it's one thing if you decide to buy some land in Sonoma, the wine growing infrastructure is there. But for you, the equipment, the vines, just, you know, the rootstock, like just getting everything there. There is no wine making infrastructure in that part of the world because you were the first.
Not only is there no winemaking infrastructure, you can't imagine what it's like going to the suppliers of vines and winemaking equipment and say, hey, I want to buy some stuff. And they go, cool, where's your vineyard? And I go, it's in the Kingdom of Bhutan. And they immediately assume that it's a scam. And I'm trying to scam them because they don't even know where Bhutan is half the time. And they're like, okay, yeah, you're a Nigerian prince and you're emailing me for some wine tanks. And so... yeah, even a funny story, when I was trying to source the very first round of vines, nobody would email me back. Nobody would respond to me. I would leave voicemail messages. Everyone thought I was doing some sort of a scam. And the only way I convinced people is I literally got in my car and I drove up to Bakersfield and I went into the nursery and I sat down with people and I said, guys, I am legit. This is what I am doing. Here's all the information. This is not a scam. I will give you money. Just give me some grapevines. And they said, huh, all right, this does seem interesting. So
that's why, that's wild. It's like, here's my money. Please take my money. What grapes? I imagine cold weather, a lot of rain. What grapes work best in the vineyards that you've planted? And what are the big environmental challenges for you guys?
So we're trying to figure that out right now. There isn't history, right? And they don't even have great weather data. And the soil is super, super diverse. And just because of the topography of the country, there's a ton of little microclimates. Like I was scouting this one vineyard and I was asking the guy, I go, hey, how much does it rain here? And he goes, oh, it doesn't rain here at all. We get a little bit of mist. And from where I was standing, I could see Paro Town. I'm like, I can see Paro Town right there. They get 1,000 millimeters of rain right there. It's like 4 miles away. And he goes, oh yeah, it rains like crazy over there. He goes, but there's this big rock outcropping over there. And when the clouds come up the valley, they hit that rock and they can't go past it. They just stop and a little bit of mist blows over. And that's just kind of, but it's not codified anywhere, right? There's no weather maps or stations. So you've got to find out by going and talking to people. So we're placing some bets. And the first round of vines we planted Bordeaux varietals, so Cab Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Malbec, and then Syrah and Pinot. And then the whites in the first round we planted Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, and Petit Mansang. And then in the second round we planted more of that stuff, but we added in Tempranillo, Sangiovese, Riesling, and Chenin. So
okay, so you're trying everything and. I mean, you might as well. It's like you're an explorer of this new land. So, yeah, you might as well try. It's almost like putting a couple bucks on all the numbers while you're playing roulette. You're just trying to see where the weather's going to fall.
That's 100% correct.
Yeah.
And I'm fairly confident that not all of the varieties are going to pan out, which is fine. I don't need them all to. I need to figure out the ones that do. And And in addition to different varietals, we're playing with different spacing methods, different trellising options, because once again, we don't know, right? So I have, you know, one vineyard that's laid out, you know, VSP and, you know, 8x5 rows. And I have another one that's terraced with like 16 feet between vines. And like, we're trying a bunch of different stuff. And we'll see what happens.
You're basically a wine mad scientist right now, and you kind of have to be. That is fascinating. Actually, one thing you mentioned at the top, that the agriculture makes the best cucumbers and the best carrots and some of the best produce you've ever had. How tough is it in terms of implementing growing strategy when the idea of making great wine is not a big, plump, luscious grape? It's a shriveled, crappy looking grape that will make the good wine.
You have hit one of the nails on the head, my friend, which is the Bhutanese are incredibly skilled agriculturalists and people from all over the world. I mean, it's a carbon negative country, and it's on track to be the first 100% organic country in the world. So people from all over go to Bhutan to study how to do sustainable agriculture in harmony with the land and everything else. They grow, they are good at growing stuff. But to your point, in their minds, you grow an orange, you want the biggest, roundest, ripest, juiciest orange possible. And we've had many conversations with them. As a matter of fact, I even put a deck together where I was showing like pictures of table grapes, wine grapes, yeah, and like high yield vineyards and low yield vineyards. And I'm like, here's a Southern California, you know, central vineyards stuff that's cropping at 12 tons an acre. And that wine sells for $8 a bottle. And here's something in Burgundy that's cropping at 1.5 tons an acre, and it sells for $400 a bottle. We want that wine.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I never thought about this. The idea of low yield is good. That must be just, I mean, that would go against the very nature of being a great farmer of produce.
Yeah, and what'll happen is, so I have these teams over there that are running these vineyards for me, and I get like daily photos of what's going on in the vineyards. And I will get like photos where it's like, look how big the canopy is. Look how many clusters we're getting. And I'm like, no, yeah, guys, slow it down. Like, that's not necessarily what we want.
Yeah.
But it's a fun adventure. Let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah.
Back to your question about like challenges. Like, we're finding all kinds of stuff that we didn't know about. Like, here's something that you probably don't have a lot of knowledge about, but sometimes monkeys get in the vineyards and they eat the grapes. So not a lot of industry data on how to solve the monkey problem in the vineyards.
Oh my God.
So I was literally, I've been asking like everyone around the world, that you know, I have a pretty good global network of wine contacts. Like, does anyone have a monkey problem? And everyone's like, no, we don't have a monkey problem. Finally, I found one person in South Africa that did have a monkey problem. And I go, oh, awesome. Like, what do you do? And she goes, we just shoot them with paintball guns.
Okay.
And I go, does it work? And she goes, yeah, for a while. Then they come back and we shoot them again. And I'm like, Bhutan's a Buddhist country. I don't think they're going to be super wild about me shooting up their local monkey population.
Yeah. I feel
so
that.
We're exploring different things.
Wow. Yeah. There must be some Bhutan farmers like, wait a minute, you shoot the monkey and you don't like lots of ripe fruit. Yeah, this is going to be an adventure, and wow, that's
so the monkeys are not just a problem for grapes, right? They're a problem for other crops too. So I'm talking to the farmers. I'm like, hey, what do you do with the monkeys in your vineyard? And they have all kinds of solutions. And one guy goes, monkeys hate snakes, so you just put a bunch of snakes in the vineyard. And I go, people hate snakes too. Like, I don't really think we need to start a cobra farm to keep the monkeys out. He goes, no. You just put a bunch of rubber snakes out. Oh. And the monkeys see them and they get scared and they run away. And I go, but then what if there's a real cobra in the vineyard and people are just kind of used to kicking the rubber snakes out of the way when they walk through? And he goes, yeah, that happens sometimes. And I'm like, well, that's not a good solution either.
No.
So I don't have the monkey problem solved yet.
Yeah. I think I might use that quote to promote this. I don't have the monkey problem solved yet. By the way, you must get so angry at like the winemakers in North America. Like I'm very close. I have family that's very close to the Niagara Escarpment. And so every now and then you can hear the boom as they're, you know, the cannon going off to scare the birds away. And it's like, here, hit that button. Birds fly away. You're dealing with snakes. And I feel bad for the people picking the grapes by hand. That's now a dangerous job.
Yep. Full contact viticulture.
What's been the best and worst moment? I mean, obviously this must be incredibly gratifying. Like, I'd love to know just for you, Michael, that moment where you felt so gratified. And then the other end, that moment when you're looking at pictures or you're there in the vineyard and you're thinking, this ain't going to work.
So I'll tell you two stories. So one of the most magical moments that we had was when we were planting the first vineyards, and I had gone through just so many hoops to get all the agricultural clearances correct and all the paperwork right. And I convinced this nursery to sell me some grapes, and we're doing all this stuff, and I'm trying to get it shipped over there. And I'm dealing with, you know, trying to get the grapes shipped by plane to Calcutta and then flown up to Delhi and then flown up into Bhutan. And so there's different shipping things, and it's a total nightmare. But I have to leave to go to Bhutan to meet the grapes, and the grapes are hung up at LAX. And so I'm sitting there at LAX with my girlfriend. So are our grapes, and we get on a plane without the grapes. Oh. And it was just a total leap of faith. Like, well, this is either going to get figured out or it's not. So I fly all the way to Bhutan. I get to Bhutan and I have a team of 30 people showing up at my hotel at 6 o'clock in the morning to plant the very first vineyard. And I don't have grapes. And so I'm sitting there and my grapes are somewhere between Los Angeles and Bhutan. And I'm sitting there at the hotel and we're like going, all right, what are our contingency plans? What do we need to do? And then 5:30 in the afternoon, I literally was sitting in front of the hotel, just kind of trying to figure out what to do. And a truck pulls in. Hey, what do you guys want these grapes? And I go, wow. So like the gods were watching. So then the next morning, so now this has actually become a reality after years and years of working. I now have grapes in the country. I have this vineyard. We go out to the vineyard. The monks show up to bless the vineyard and bless the project. I plant the very first grape vine, Merlot, by the way. For the record, I plant this grapevine, and just as I plant it, there's a little bit of mist in the air, and there's one of those big giant rings around the sun that you see sometimes.
Yep.
And everybody stops working, and everyone starts like pointing at the sky and yelling. And apparently, that's like one of the best omens possible in the Bhutanese culture. And so I'm literally standing there, and it was just this super powerful moment. Like, holy shit, we did this. The gods are watching us. They're blessing this project. This is going to happen. So that was like a triumphant moment.
Absolutely.
The non-triumphant moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Non-triumphant moment was, so I'm going through this same thing again with these two vineyards that we planted earlier in the year. And we've been like hustling to get these things clear. We pulled 400 truckloads of rocks out of one of the vineyards and cutting down all the trees, and we're doing all this prep work. And I go and I literally put my vines on a plane to send them to Calcutta, and India closes the country. India goes full lockdown. And so now my grapes are sitting on the runway, basically in Calcutta, heating up. And when they heat up, they come alive. And,
yeah.
And I'm like, what are we going to do? And so we convinced the Indian folks to let us take the grapes. So we pick the grapes up and we drive up to Bhutan. But the Bhutan border is also closed to anything coming in from India. So now my grapes are not on the runway. Now they're in a truck heating up at the border, and they won't let us in. And I'm trying to negotiate all this and navigate all this from the US because I'm not there. And so I'm like, okay, this is going to be a problem. We figure out how to navigate that. We get into the country of Bhutan, and a COVID case comes out in the capital city of Thimphu. So they shut the city down, but I need to drive through the city to get to my vineyards, which are on the other side. And so, and it's like every single day, it's just one more challenge. Like, And I'm like, now the gods are conspiring against me. And my grapes are just getting gradually warmer and warmer and warmer and warmer. But we figured it out, and we got those grapes in the ground, and they started growing like crazy. But there was about a week of a lot of anxiety on my part.
What's more difficult? Supply chain issues for Bhutan or attempting to get your master of wine?
Well, when you started with supply chain issues, I was immediately going to say supply chain issues, but
yeah,
when you compare it to the MW, I mean, there's a reason why there's more astronauts in the United States than there are masters of wine.
Yep.
It's freaking hard to do. And I would say, for me, I entered into the process not necessarily knowing for sure that I could do it, but wanting the experience. And that program has led me to places I never dreamed I would go. It's taken me all over the world. It's the reason that there's a wine industry in the Kingdom of Bhutan. Because if I had not been doing that, I wouldn't have been going all over the world. I wouldn't have had the same epiphany when I got to Bhutan. And so it's led me to all this stuff. I hope I can get through it. I hope I pass. But if I don't, then I've gotten out of it what I came to it for. And like, yeah, it'd be nice to have the initials after my name, but without all the other stuff, the initials are just a kind of an ego thing. And so we'll see what happens. I took the exam again this year. I've passed everything except the tasting part, but I failed the tasting part 3 times in a row. I just took the tasting part again for the 4th time in September. I find out November 24th. Not that I'm counting.
Okay, hold on. I need to know, because, I mean, I don't have the master. I got my WSET diploma a couple of years ago. So I've certainly been involved in a lot of those sort of tastings. What the ones that you didn't pass in, do you remember like some of those moments when you're like, I have no idea what this is? It's like, and you know, bleep you. Are you really giving me, is this an Alvarino or a Pinot Grigio? What are you doing to me? Like, I'm wondering, do you have any of those like tasting horror stories?
I have nothing but tasting horror stories. Matter of fact, I think there's definitely the moments where you put your nose in the glass and the wine is just not speaking to you.
Yep.
And you're just sort of like, okay, what do I do now? That to me, doesn't bother me that much because I immediately go to structure and I start deconstructing structure, right? And I'm like, okay, I might not know what this is, but I can at least figure out, you know, what the acid levels are, what the alcohol levels are, where I think this is from. You know, is it finishing fruity, you know, from like a New World style? Or you can at least kind of talk intelligently about the wine, even if you don't know what it is. What's worse is and this happened, this one's right in my brain because it just happened on this year's tasting exam. I was on paper 3, which is the kind of mixed bag. And there was a vintage natural and there was a vintage port. And, and those are very similar style wines, right?
Yeah.
I put my nose in the first one and I'm like, this is Grenache. It's strawberry driven. This is a VDN. The quality is really high. I'm thinking that this is a Banyuls. So I write it all up. Then I get to the next wine and it's very similar. And I go, oh, this is a port. And so I write it all up as a port. We get to the end of the session, you know, you hit, you know, time's up. Close your computers. I close my computers. They're like, all right, dump your wines. And I go to nose what I think is the VDN.
Yeah.
And the second I put my nose in, I'm like, oh my God, that's obviously port. This is obviously port. And I flip-flop them. But at that point, like you're done. Like the computer's shut. And I just, maybe it didn't open up for me like during the tasting, but so lots of moments like that. And then there's always the moment when they release the wines. So you haven't got your scores yet, but they release the wine. So this year, for example, one of the wines was sparkling and I thought it was terrible. I thought it was like low quality California, like sparkling Moscato. It had no nose. It had no sugar. Yeah. Turns out it was a Cuvée Champagne. Yeah. You look at that, and you're like, swing and a miss. You don't have to get it perfectly. You know, no. you just need to get enough points to pass. So I'm holding out hope.
I wish you
took the WSET diploma when you did the Wines of the World. Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah.
I hope it works.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I think the one that made me the happiest was it was Pinot. They said same grape from different parts of the world. And I nailed the Spey Burgunder. So I nailed that. So I got the German Pinot right. And that made me very happy when I later learned that I nailed that. That one made me happy.
Dude, there's nothing better when there's something that is a little bit out there and you're able to rationalize and not guess, but like have a good reason why I think this is Spätburgunder. And then sure enough, it is. And you kind of go like, all right, maybe I'm not an idiot after all. Maybe I can do this. Those moments are always fantastic.
It is so true. And even like, I'm sure with you do it, you're at parties and people will pour you something and go, guess what it is. And it both annoys you. It excites you. And I find when I nail it, I'm about 18% happier than I should be. Like the rest of the night, I'm like, I nailed that. I said it was Ribera del Douro. Like I nailed that one. Like you feel better than maybe you should.
So I was in New York this last weekend doing a book signing. And so after the book signing, like that exact thing was happening. Like people were pouring me, oh, here, do this one. And so I get this white wine that I don't know what it is. I'm like, I feel like this is Marsan-Roussan, but it's not quite Marsan-Roussan. And then I'm like, it's got a bunch of orange to it. Maybe it's Albarino, like, but the acid's not quite high enough for Albarino. So I'm sort of rationalizing through kind of what I think it is. Turns out it was a Napa blend of like Marsan-Roussan, Picpoul, Albarino, Pinot Blanc, and like a couple other things. And so there's no way I would have ever called that wine. But yeah. I was like super gratified that my analysis of it was, well, maybe it could be Albarino, not enough acid. That's because the Marsan-Roussan is bringing in a lot more waxiness and texture to it. But there's not enough of it in the blend to get you there. So, yeah.
By the way, whoever poured you that wine, what a jerk.
That was a diabolical move, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Hey, I want to hear more about just your own past when it comes to wine, but you mentioned your book and you got the newsletter. I was wondering if you would tell people a little bit about drinking and knowing things.
Yeah. So I've written a bunch of books about wine, more wine fiction. Mm-hmm. And like more like Ocean's 11 kind of hustle stories, but all related to the world of fine wine. And so my friends that know, you know, that I'm a decent writer were constantly after me to like send out wine recommendations. Like, tell me what I should be buying. Like, give me some stuff. So, and I was like, dude, I'm not responsible for your wine consumption. Go try some stuff, figure out what you like, drink more of the stuff you like, drink less of the stuff you don't like, just do it like that. But I was on a plane. And I was reading this wine book. This was, I don't know, 18 months or so ago. And in the book, they were ripping on Chenin Blanc. They're like, Chenin Blanc is a garbage grape. And I'm like, no, it is not.
No, it is not.
Chenin Blanc is awesome.
Yeah.
And I was annoyed. I was pissed. So I went home and I wrote an email to like 10 of my friends saying, you should go drink Chenin Blanc because it's awesome and screw this guy for saying it's not. And they all like got it. And they're like, this is awesome. Will you send me another one? And so I go, all right. And this is right when kind of lockdown was starting to happen. So I just started sending these emails out once a week to like this group of my friends. And then those emails got forwarded and those people forwarded it. And next thing you know, I got thousands of people around the world, like hit me up for wine recommendations. And so I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. And so I packaged the first 52 recommendations together into a book with the idea that someone who wasn't knowledgeable about wine and doesn't want to get super geeky and go do WSET, you could get that book and you could read 5 minutes every week about a wine you probably don't know about and buy a bottle of that wine and taste it. See if you like it. Maybe you do, maybe you don't, whatever. But at the end of that year, you'd be as conversant in wine as most sommeliers. You could have conversations with people. You'd have some sense of like what you liked and what you didn't. So I put this out there and then it became a bestseller. So I was like, wow, that's awesome.
That is great. And by the way, Chenin Blanc, I mean, just the range of that grape. And I mean, Sauvignon is one of the great wine. It's one of those white wines you decant before you drink it. And it's ridiculous.
Sauvignon is awesome. But I like the, you know, the off-dry styles from Vouvray.
Oh, yeah.
Almost maybe more than I like Sauvignon. And Sauvignon is amazing. And then South Africa, like they're doing their own style, and it's a lot of times got a little bit of oak, but not in an offensive way. Chenin's great.
Yeah.
And here's this celebrated expert saying it's just a garbage grape. I'm like, no, it's not. You know what you're talking about.
You know, that's because like my other job is I'm a sports talk radio host. That's just a wine hot take. It's like saying LeBron James is a choke artist. You're just saying that. You're saying that for clicks. You're saying that to stir up shit. So, you know. So if you're saying Chenin Blanc is trash, you're just doing that you're just making a bad hot take.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that.
Yeah,
because there's no way that you could, I think, argue that it is not objectively a great wine grape. Styles are great. The values are great. You know, people do it all over the world for a reason. So that's how the whole thing started. So I ended up with the best-selling book because I got annoyed at this person saying Chenin was bad.
Well, quickly promote. Where can people find the newsletter? Where can they find your book?
For sure. I'm not a marketing guy. I'm a wine geek, right? So if I forget about the opportunities to do like the self-promotion stuff. But so the book is called Drinking and Knowing Things. And you can get it on Amazon in electronic format or in paperback. I think it's available in most countries around the world. The newsletter itself is drinkingandknowingthings.com, and people could just go and sign up. They just go and enter their email address. You'll start getting the newsletter recommendations. And you know, unsubscribe whenever you want. It's pretty low key. My goal in doing it, this is the God's honest truth, Matt. We screwed up wine in the US, and I want to bring that kind of joyous adventure back to wine in the US. And I'm doing my little part to help people realize like you can have fun with this. You don't have to be intimidated by it. You don't have to spend $100 to get a good bottle of wine. You can spend $20 and get an awesome bottle of Vouvray and enjoy the hell out of it. And that's all it should be about. It's fermented grape juice. There's no magic to it.
Well, that's the point of this podcast. That's why I have the ridiculously goofy long name, so that people at least realize that, okay, maybe every now and then you're going to hear about trellising and acidity and soil type, but it's also here just to have fun and just talk about wine. It's not meant to be taken too seriously.
Yeah. And you know what? I would way rather hear about the wine fight that happens in Rioja every year, where people load up squirt guns and they go out in the vineyards and they spend the day having a giant wine fight.
Yeah,
I would way rather hear about that than trellising. And I'm actually worried about trellising because of Bhutan. But yeah, the wine fight is way more fun.
The sad thing is sometimes, I agree with you most of the time, but you know what? I can get sucked into a good trellis conversation, but that's probably why I'm doing a wine podcast. Hey, so in your mind then, with the United States, and it's, you know, it's not just the States, it's probably in other places, but it's just that we created a culture where wine has become intimidating. And I still see it with friends of mine or my girlfriend, where they'll say, when I'm going to the wine store, I get intimidated. And I'm always like, no, that's where the fun and the joy is. There's countries and stories and winemakers and crazy things that happen to make that wine. It should be celebrated.
Totally. I actually did this thing when I first started getting serious about learning about wine, where I would go into wine stores and my rule was, I could only buy things if I didn't know what they were. And so I would walk around and like, I don't know what this Zamarodi is. I guess I'll get a bottle of that. And I don't know if it's sweet or dry or what, but I'm going to get it home and I'm going to find out. And it was an awesome adventure. And that's how I kind of dialed my pot. And I did that for about probably a year and a half. I didn't know what it was.
That's a great, by the way, for people listening, that's a great way to doing it. Sorry to interrupt. For people listening, that's a great way of doing it. Go to the wine store, LCBO, wherever you live in the world, buy a bottle you've never heard of, take down some notes. If you like it, hooray. If you don't like it, avoid it like the plague next time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, Europe has had the benefit of making wine for thousands of years, right? And so it's just an ingrained part of their culture. But then, you know, the US came onto the scene really in like the late 60s, right? With Mondavi saying, hey, we could be as good as the French. And so I think we had to take it a little bit more seriously, so we got respect and credibility.
Right.
And that snowballed. And now we're this whole culture of like this big intimidating thing. And the French are like, hey, let's have a wine fight, you know? and so we need to the pendulum to swing back the other way, I think.
We're overcompensating. Like every Pinot producer says, we make our wines in the Burgundian style. I'm like, you're in Napa. Right. You don't make it. You can love Burgundy, but you make the Napa style. You might honor Burgundy, but stop saying Burgundian. We're overcompensating.
Yeah. And I think we needed to do that in the 60s and 70s. I don't think we need to do it now. I think our quality and our style stands on its own. I prefer the styles of wine from Europe, me as an individual, but I greatly respect what people are doing in Sonoma and Napa and Willamette and Southern Washington and Paso and cool stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there's single vineyard Pinots in Ontario that can compete with Burgundy, but yeah, like a lot of us, usually we start Old World and we work our way back to where we're from. So, I'm going to do one more marathon, at least in my life. And I want to do Medoc. Like the Bordeaux Marathon is the one I want to do. I was wondering if you could tell me your Medoc and Alsace Marathon experiences and like specifically, how tempted were you to drink wine early? How late did you hold off? I want to hear the wine marathon strategy.
Okay. Not a problem. So I actually, of the two, I preferred the Alsace Marathon more. If you've never been to Alsace, like the scenery there is spectacular. So you run through like 17 medieval villages and the vineyards between them. So you go like vineyard, village. And it's a lot smaller. So there's way fewer people and it's a lot more camaraderie. On that race, they do basically it's 12 stations of food and wine pairing. So everyone runs to the first station and then stops and has a party and a band plays. And then everyone eats and drinks and then runs to the next one. And you just sort of repeat that for 26 miles. And it is a blast. So the strategy for that is have as much fun as humanly possible and enjoy the food and wine. Medoc is a shit show. It's so crowded. You know, like I think the year I did it, there was like 8,500 runners. But you're running through the vineyards. And so the trails are not that wide. And so everyone's kind of packed in and they do this thing called the sweep. They have like this cart with brooms that comes at the end and they sweep you off the course if you're not going fast enough.
Right.
And so what happens is you're constantly in this, you're jostling for position, you know, with the sea of people and you're trying to drink the wines, but you're also cognizant of the guys running up behind you with the cart and moving people off the course. So with that race, I started drinking right from minute one, which made it fun. And then we got to about, I don't know, mile 10, at which point we were going through like the heart of Margaux and stopping at like, you know, some great, great wineries. And I'm like, the wine is just spectacular. I'm going to have more fun doing this. And I'm just going to slow my pace way down. And so that's kind of what we did. And then I got to the halfway point and I didn't make the cutoff.
Oh no.
They were screwed around. So they booted us off the cart. And I didn't even know there was a cutoff. I just was worried about staying in front of the cart with the broom guys. And so I was like, not thinking about cutoff. We were having a great time. We posted up at, the Léoville wineries. So La Caz and Poffrère. And they were both doing tastings and there was bands. Like we must've stayed there for 15 minutes, just hanging out and drinking this amazing, you know, second growth Bordeaux. And then all of a sudden we get to the turn and it's like, you're not running fast enough. So I didn't get to finish that marathon. But I had a hell of a lot of fun. So if you want a finishing strategy, I'm not your guy. But if you want a fun strategy, that's the way I did it. And it was so awesome.
So clearly no personal bests were set in Europe.
No. And actually, when I did the Alsace Marathon, I did it with my son. I did it with a group of people, but my son kind of came to run it. And my son is not a marathon runner. So he ended up needing some care and feeding along the course, which I was totally fine with. I'm like, I'm in the vineyards. I'm in the medieval villages. I'm eating foie gras and Pinot Blanc at mile 16. Like, this is amazing. But I think my time was like, 6.5 hours or some ungodly thing, but totally worth doing. I like I said, if you're going to do one, my suggestion would be Alsace rather than Bordeaux, but the wine's probably better in Bordeaux. The other one that I want to do is they do one in Mendoza too. And I've not been to Mendoza, but they do a marathon, same sort of thing. So that's on my list too. Once the pandemic opens back up.
Yeah. Oh God. I thank you for that strategy, by the way. Okay. That is good to know. I can't wait to do it. I think I'd be too afraid to drink until near the end. But then when you say you can try second growth Bordeaux, who's kidding who? Of course, I'm going to guzzle some back.
Of course you are. Yeah. And especially when there's no limits. It's like, have as much as you'd like. And like, when you get the opportunity to go drink as much rated growth Bordeaux at the winery, even if you planned a trip, a tasting trip to Bordeaux, you couldn't even get access to a bunch of those wineries, you know? So the one thing I would say is they are legit sticklers about that medical sign-off thing. So you probably want to make sure that they make you get a doctor's note to run the marathon.
Oh, okay. That's I've never had to do that anywhere in North America, but.
Nah, me neither. But they, and I did it. And when I got there, they were like fanatical about checking the boxes to make sure that you've done it. So word to the wise.
Good to know.
Don't scrimp on that.
Michael, this has been fantastic. I was reading somewhere that you're hoping to down the road with Bhutan to have people come and stay and plant grapes. And I as we end this, I was wondering if you could talk about that and where you hope to see wine culture in Bhutan 5-10 years from now.
Our vision is a much longer term vision, even than 5-10 years. I'm thinking more along a 50-year time horizon for the most part, because, you know, by then I'll be dead. where I see the potential for it to go is where you have a thriving wine community and culture that hits all the ancillary pieces. So there's hospitality, there's hotels, you can go and visit, and you can visit tasting rooms, and you can go into, sit in vineyards and drink the wine from there and talk to the people that made it. And I think we can, part of our strategy is, there's a lot of subsistence farmers there that are growing things like rice. And so they'll grow rice on patties. And then between the patties are hillside slopes that aren't good for rice, but they are good for grapevines. And so I'd love to see a model where we have all these subsistence farmers who, you know, can plant and cultivate grapes on their plots, similar to how it works in Champagne, right? You have a bunch of family farms. They grow grapes according to, you know, the rules of Champagne, and then they participate in the prosperity of the region. And I think that would be amazing if we could let all the people in the country really participate in it. And I think Bhutan's a bucket list destination today for many tourists, right? Like, going there is like the be all and end all. And so to augment that experience for them with also some wine experience will just make it that much better of an experience for everyone that goes there. And I can't say enough good things about the country. The country is just such a special, magical place. If we can add wine to it, it'll just be, in my opinion, that much more magical.
One more time, Michael, where do people go for the newsletter?
They go to drinkingandknowingthings.com. They can follow us at bhutanwine.com, Instagram, Drinking and Knowing Things, or Bhutan Wine. I want to share Bhutan with the world. If anyone is interested at all going there, reach out to me, man. I'll help make it happen.
It's so cool. I really appreciate you doing the podcast. It's a great story. We didn't even get to you drinking old Italian wine with your father when you were younger in your 20s. We'll have to save that for another time. Love to get you back on. Michael, all the best. Good luck with the master. Good luck with the vines. And hopefully we run into each other again. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, me too. Thanks again, Matt, for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to share with the story with the world.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.